In our study this morning, we're continuing to talk about King David, relationship with Saul. Of course, we just concluded the book of 1 Samuel and noted that King Saul is dead. He has been buried. And now in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, we began to discuss in more detail David and his service of the people of God as king. Now, in our lesson book, one of the things that I did not see is very much elaboration at all in the first chapter of 2 Samuel. Our book begins with the events of the second chapter of 1 Samuel. Very quickly, however, I want to go back and review just a few of the passages that I want you to remember. And I'm doing this, of course, as most of you know, from other classes that we've had deliberately so that we can be able to recall them without having to think too much about them. When Moses brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Israel, he warned them about what would happen if they began to worship idols. In the book of Deuteronomy, there are three chapters, or three places, I should say, in particular that I want you to remember. What are they? First of all, Deuteronomy chapter 4, then Deuteronomy chapter 8, and then 28 through 30. We know that when Joshua brought the children of Israel into the promised land, he told them that everything that God has promised has been fulfilled. And that's found in Joshua, what chapters? Two of them. Chapter 21, verses 43 through 44. Or 45, and then chapter 21, verses 14 through 16. 23, what did I say?
21.
Joshua chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. Now, in all of these together, we learn that if they worship idols, what did God tell them would happen?
Lose the land.
Lose the land. That's right. Now, when Joshua brought them into the promised land, he assured them that this is going to be the consequence. During the period of the judges, what occurred? In book of Judges.
You see new generations.
All right, we've got a new generation on the scene. We've got a circle. How many times did they go around that circle? Under how many? 15 different judges. 15 different judges. Now, key in, we're counting Abimelech in that list. 15 different judges. And how many years? A little over 300 years. They went around that cycle, being faithful to God, rebelling against God. God raised up an oppressor. They would repent and turn to God, and then they'd be faithful to God for a while, and around they'd go.
Just an interjection. When I was reviewing what we've read, I noticed that Samuel actually did appoint his sons to be judges.
All right.
But they were bad.
That's right.
They were taking bribes. They weren't very good judges at all. When the people came, when they came and asked for a king, they didn't come to see his sons and ask for a king. They came back to Samuel. And I'm guessing that's why we don't count them in the number.
Correct.
Because they would have been 17 years.
Yeah.
We just don't even consider them.
Don't consider them judges. They weren't faithful to the Lord.
Yeah.
No. They weren't faithful to the Lord. And so, that's right. Now, when we go back to the time of Moses, to the time then of 1 Samuel 7, when they appoint a king, about how many years have passed? Close to a little over 300. The period of the judges was 300 years. Then you've got to add to that the conquest of the land. And then you've got to add to that the time in the wilderness under the leadership of Moses. So when you add all that together, you're getting closer to 400 years from the time that Moses initially told them that they would ask for a king. Now, Saul has proven himself to be a very humble king, but then he became very arrogant. And he rebelled against God in 1 Samuel chapter 13, and then again in 1 Samuel chapter 15. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, what did he do?
Offered sacrifice when he wasn't told.
offer a sacrifice. Samuel said, wait, he didn't do it. 1 Samuel chapter 13.
And not even just that, he didn't have the authority to do it.
That's right, he was not a priest. Exactly. And then in 1 Samuel chapter 15, what occurred? That's exactly right. And so consequently, Samuel has told him now what will occur. What could have been. What could have been. All right. All right, someone after his own heart. Of course, that brings us then to the time of David. We find that there were years that God did not speak to Saul. And finally, through Samuel being brought up by the witch of Endor, what did Samuel tell him was going to happen to him in the battle with the Philistines?
He's
going to die.
And his sons would die.
And his sons would die. And of course, we read that and know that's true in chapter 30 and 31 of the book of 1 Samuel. Now, in 2 Samuel, as I mentioned a moment ago, in 2 Samuel, our lesson book really omits the events of chapter 1. But in the events of chapter 1, what is the discussion that's taking place? David receives the report of Saul's death. And how is it reported? All right, that's how he died. He fell on his sword. But how is it reported to David that he died? All right. An Amalekite came up and he reports to David that I saw him in bad shape and so I finished him off. I killed him. Well, what did David do to the Amalekite? He killed him. That's right. Verse 14 of chapter 1. It said, and David said unto him, how wast thou not afraid to put forth thy hand to destroy God's anointed? And David called one of the young men and said, go near and fall upon him. And he smote him so that he died. And David said unto him, thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth has testified against thee, saying, I have slain Jehovah's anointed. Well, he hadn't. But that was his report, and David killed him because that was his report. Now, in the second chapter of 2 Samuel, and by the way, I want to pause here on this particular chart, as we did Wednesday night, for those of you who were not in the class on Wednesday night, I want you to note the date when David ruled. David ruled about 1,000 years before the coming of Christ. Very significant because we don't have to depend totally upon biblical history to know when David ruled. It's a historical fact that David ruled over the people of Israel, and we know who were kings contemporary with him, so we can date the time of David's rule. And so about 1,000 years before Jesus was born is the time frame that we're talking about. Always notice in your lesson book the passages that are referenced. Now, if you're reading from 2 Samuel on through 1 Kings chapter 2, you'll read somewhat of a consecutive account of the reign of King David. Additional details are given in the Chronicles, much like your reading of the life of Christ in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You see additional details given in the various books of the same time frame, many of the same events, but often added details. So when you're studying from 2 Samuel, the Kings, and the Chronicles, be aware to read all of it that is at the heading of your lesson in your lesson book, so you can keep up with the things that we're going to be studying from lesson to lesson. Now, another thing that we want to note as we preface our study of 2 Chronicles is that David was indeed a man after God's own heart. In Acts chapter 13, as the Apostle Paul preaches in the synagogue of the Jews in Antioch of Pisidia, he's giving a history of the nation of Israel. And the purpose of that is to show that God has brought forth a Savior according to promise. And of course that through the lineage of David, as he's mentioned in this particular text, a man after God's own heart. By the way, you'll notice in Acts chapter 13, the language is very similar to the speech that Stephen gave in Acts chapter 7, as he speaks to the Jews, likewise rehearsing their history. Now, when we talk about a man after God's own heart, it's noteworthy that we're not talking about someone that is perfect. David made some very grave blunders, sinned grievously, and we'll talk about those as we get to them. But when David committed sin, and it was pointed out to him, the things that he did, we see that he sought to correct those things, and it was his desire to rule as God wanted him to rule. Now, in our Romans study, in Romans chapter 4, we noted a quotation given from David. And if you'll turn over to Romans chapter 4 and notice the first few verses of that chapter. Romans chapter 4, pick up the reading if you would, beginning in verse 1 if you would. The place we want to read is specifically in verse 6, but in verse 1, the apostle is defining the kind of faith that saves. And in verse 1 of chapter 4, he said, "What then shall we say that Abraham our forefather hath found according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he hath whereof to glory, but not toward God. For what saith the Scriptures? And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned unto him for righteousness. Now to him that worketh, the reward is not reckoned as of grace, but as of debt. But to him that worketh not, believeth on him that justifieth the ungodly, his faith is reckoned for righteousness, even as David also pronounceth blessing upon the man unto whom God reckoneth righteousness apart from works, saying, Blessed are they whose iniquities are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not reckon sin." Now, Paul goes back and discusses righteous Abraham and how that Abraham's faith is reckoned unto him for righteousness. But this portion quoted now from Psalms chapter 32 is quoted here from David. David recognizes that the man who is truly blessed is the man whose sin is covered, the man whose sin is forgiven. Now, understanding that, we lay that against the backdrop of David's sin, and we notice how grievous it was. We'll talk about that as our study progresses. But you'll notice that the whole second Samuel addresses the reign of David. So we've got a whole lot of information devoted to David, especially when we add to that the Psalms. And note that most of the Psalms were written by David. We note that we are first introduced to David in 1 Samuel chapter 16 as he is anointed as king, and we read of his death in 1 Kings chapter 2. But most of the Psalms were written by David. And, of course, some very familiar Psalms, the 23rd Psalm, we see the confidence that David has in God. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, so forth. And then the deep grief that is expressed by David relative to his sin. If you'll notice, first of all, in Psalms chapter 32, once again it tells us in verse 1, "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man unto whom Jehovah imputeth not iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile." Now look at verse 3 as he continues. "When I kept silence, my bones wasted away through my groaning all the day long. For day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture was changed as with the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin unto thee, and mine iniquity did I not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions unto Jehovah, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sin. When we look in passages like this, and there are others, we see that as David had committed sin against God, resulting in a number of consequences to be imposed upon him. What was his attitude toward his sin? When he kept silence, what did his sin do to him? It just killed him. It did. It just ate him up from the inside out. In Psalms chapter 51, you'll note beginning in verse 3, he said, "For I know my transgression, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned, and done that which was evil, or which is evil in thy sight, that thou mayest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. And behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." In verse 10 through 12, and especially you'll note in verse 16 and 17, David would do anything that could be done to make himself right, to offer a sacrifice. He would do that, but that didn't suffice the problem. For David said in verse 17, "The sacrifices of Jehovah are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise." You know, as we look at passages like this, and let's say for illustration's sake that we've been unfaithful to the Lord for a period of time, and we think then that the solution of that is then we'll just kind of drift back in from time to time and slowly begin to worship the Lord again, and everything's good. Is that how David expressed it? Not quite. No, David's unfaithfulness to the Lord broke his heart, and it provoked him to do something about it. And we need to see what sin does. And David expresses that, how that it just killed him inside. And you don't see that many times being manifested in the lives of many. In fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, the Apostle Paul said that godly sorrow brings forth repentance. Well, what is godly sorrow? It's something that begins with a broken heart because what I've done has offended God. I fear sometimes we don't see the magnitude of all of that. But this is the man that God was looking for to be king of his people, a man after his own heart. Now, yes.
When in that situation, so many people that don't have the heart that we should have, that David showed, with the sorrow in their hands, so many people either attempt to cover it up, or some people just live in denial and say, "I didn't do anything wrong."
Yeah.
Yeah. And where does that lead? Well, you know, that leads to never being justified inside of God if you go down those paths. You're farther ahead, you know, admitting the error and then asking for forgiveness and repenting from it.
That's right. We may be in the assembly, but we're still not right with the Lord. And should we die in that circumstance, we'd be lost. And we need to be impressed with that. All right. Now, in the second chapter, I said that our lesson book primarily begins with the second chapter. Of course, that's true, but we know that David is anointed as king in Hebron. You see that in verse 3. It says, "His men that were come up with him did David bring, and every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." Now that's interesting to me. David is recognized by those of Judah as being king. Who do the rest recognize as being king?
Ishbosheth.
That's right. Now who's he?
Saul's son.
That's Saul's son. Now he's anointed as king, or set up to be king, in Mahanaim by Abner, Saul's chief captain. Now, while we're talking about chief captains, who was David's chief captain?
Joab.
We want to keep these characters straight. Abner and Joab. We've talked about Abner somewhat in the past. I think it's significant in this portion of our text that we note not only who he is, but a change that takes place in Abner. At first, we see that Abner has not only anointed Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, to be king of the people of God, but he is, for the most part, at war with those who would recognize the authority of David. Now, dropping down in the text of chapter 2, reading beginning in verse 10. No, verse 8. Let's back up to verse 8. It says, "Now Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and made him king over Gilead, and over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months." This is going to become very significant to us in just a little bit. In verses 12 through verse 17, Abner makes a proposition to those who are the servants of David. What is the proposition? Let's fight it out. Yeah. You bring out your men, and I think the number was 12, and we'll bring out our men, and let's let them play, is the word that's used here. But what is it that is the result then of the battle? David wins. All of those of Abner's men are slain with the knife or sword. In fact, the place is called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon, which means the field of the sharp knives. And wouldn't you like to go there and play? The field of the sharp knives. But Abner was beaten, and the men of Israel that day before the servants of David. Now, there are three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now, these three men become some very important players just here. We know that Asahel is described, I like the description in verse 18, light-footed, like a wild roe. Asahel pursued after Abner. Why?
He was the enemy,
yes. Well, his desire is to kill him. But of course, now Abner is a very skilled man of war. Asahel is not necessarily so. But we find that as Asahel is attempting to follow after Abner, Abner stops at least twice and asks him, in essence, "Do you really want to follow me?" Gives him a couple of chances to return from following me, but he doesn't do so. And in verse 23, it tells us, "Howbeit he refused to turn aside, wherefore Abner, with the hinder end of the spear, smote him in the body, so that the spear came out behind him. And he fell down there and died in the same place. And it came to pass that as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood there." Now, what is it that Joab and Abishai decide we're going to do? We're going to kill him. And so they continue to pursue Abner. Now that causes Abner to raise a question to Joab. Now remind me again, who's Joab? The chief captain of David. Now, interestingly enough, Abner and Joab, they know about warfare. And so Abner asks Joab, essentially, "How long are we going to keep this up? What's ultimately going to happen? Somebody's going to die. I mean, we've got captains here, and they're leading men, and we're finding that men are dying, and this has to find a place to stop somewhere. And so what then does Joab decide to do?
Ceasefire.
That's right. I like that. We're going to have a ceasefire. And so as a result of the ceasefire, did the fires really cease?
No.
Well, in chapter 3, it tells us, beginning in verse 1, there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. Now, as you begin reading in verse 2, I've asked you to note passages that identify the wives of David. And this is a good place to mark, if you're marking in your text, verses 2 through verse 5. The wives of David. How many do you count here?
Six
wives of David. And we haven't even gotten to Bathsheba yet. And we haven't even gotten to the numerous concubines that later David takes. But here we count six wives. What was it that Moses said when you ask for a king that the kings are not to do?
Multiply wives.
Now here's David doing the very thing that Moses has told them that you're not to do. Now, I'm going to catch up my charts here just a little bit, I think. We've got Hebron, David, the man after God's own heart, power struggle in the land. All right, chapter 3 is where I want to be. When we read of Abner and the relationship as it continues to worsen, Abner, I want to say this candidly. Abner wants to have a position similar to that of Saul among the people of Israel. And if you'll note in verses 6 through verse 11, what is it that Abner did? He took Saul's concubine. Now, what did Ish-bosheth, whom Abner has declared to be king, what did he say to Abner about taking his father's concubine? Now, why did you do that? And so, yes, Abner said, "Am I a dog's head that belongeth to Judah?" What's Abner declaring? What's he want to be? I've heard several things and didn't understand one of them. What's he want to be? He wants to be kind of a king. He wants a place of power. So this power struggle seems to continue. Well, when Ish-bosheth has rebuked him for taking his father's concubine, what does Abner tell him? More than just about this being a dog in Judah.
He's going to switch allegiance to David.
Yes, he is. And what then does Ish-bosheth do? Kind of draws in his horns. He's afraid of Abner. He's afraid of Abner. And he does indeed switch allegiance. In verse 12 of chapter 3, Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "Whose is the land?" Saying also, "Make thy league with me, and behold, my hand shall be with thee to bring about all Israel unto thee." Now, there's a price to that. What's the price, David?
Bring Michal,
Saul's daughter. She's supposed to be my wife, you know. But we know that Saul has given Michal, supposedly David's wife, to somebody else. What's his name?
Paltiel,
that's right. Now, what is it that Abner does with Michal and Paltiel?
Separates.
That's what he does. He goes and gets Michal. And what does Paltiel do all the way home? All right, he's really, really upset. You'll notice in verse...
But first he goes with her.
Goes with her.
That's right.
Send him back home. And then what happens to Abner? He's fulfilled his end of the deal. He's brought together the empire under the reign of King David.
Well, but he goes in peace. But then Joab starts this rumble about this alliance and calls Abner back, and his brother kills him.
He does. Yeah. And why do they kill him? Why can't he just leave it alone?
Because of his brother.
That's right. It was his brother that Abner killed. And so Joab is not content.
Yeah, I guess you've gotten to that part of the story. But that's one thing that I've never found particularly offensive. Joab had every right under the law to kill the man who killed his brother. Now, that he used deceit to do that is probably wrong. But I don't know what the big hoorah is about Joab killing Abner. Abner deserved to die as far as Joab's family was concerned.
That's true. I can't argue with that. But it was contrary to what David had said be done. He sent him home in peace. And David as king, that should have been honored. And Abner did not do that. Now, consequently, you'll note in began about verse 28. It said, and afterward, when David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before Jehovah forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that hath an issue, or that is a leper, or that leaneth upon a staff, or that falleth by the sword, or that lacketh bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, slew Abner because he had killed their brother, Asahel, at Gibeon in the battle. Now, David rent his clothes, and I want you to notice this. There's a familiar expression that we find in this next paragraph, and we often use it and sometimes fail to realize who it's used about. But if you'll note in verse 38, it says, the king said unto his servants, know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? And I am this day weak, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too hard for me. Jehovah reward the evildoer according to his wickedness. What is it that David calls upon all of Israel to do?
Honor Abner.
Honor Abner. That's interesting to me. He recognizes who Abner is. He has been, in times past, an adversary, but he didn't die an adversary. And so David calls upon all of Israel to give honor unto Abner, verses 33 through verse 38. Now, Ish-bosheth, the king of Saul, what was it that God had said regarding the kingdom of Saul? Not going to continue. And as we read further into this fourth chapter, we read of two men, one by the name of Baana and the other Rechab, and they are sons of Rimmon. And what do they do to Ish-bosheth? They kill him. That's right. In fact, they cut off his head, and they think they've done a great thing by bringing the head of Ish-bosheth to David. And what did David have to say about that? Now, you didn't really do all that great of a thing. Beginning at verse 10, it says, when one told me, saying, behold, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his tidings. How much more when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed? Shall I not now require his blood of your hand and take you away from the earth? So David commanded his young men, and they slew them and cut off their hands and their feet and hanged them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. Well, why have these fellows done such a bad thing? Why is David so upset that they've killed Ish-bosheth?
Well,
a couple of reasons.
Saul was the Lord's anointed. son.
That's right. It's his son. Now, how did they go about to kill Ish-bosheth?
He didn't. Killed him when he was asleep.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't even die in battle. They didn't give him a chance. And so that was a dishonorable way to kill him. So as David pronounces judgment on that, these men then are to be slain. Now, there's one element that we haven't mentioned from chapter 4 regarding another descendant of King Saul, and that is Jonathan's son. His name, Jenny, is
Mephibosheth.
That's right. Now, we want to remember him. What was wrong with him? He's lame. How did he become lame? All right. Nurse dropped him. Dropped him on his head. Well, no, we don't know that. But what we do know is that in fleeing from the battle with the Philistines, Mephibosheth is made lame. And eventually we note that David took him into his house and provided for him the things that he needed from that point on. Now, in chapter 5 of 2 Samuel, we know that David has become the king, verses 1 through 5. And it tells us in verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 30 and 3 years over all Israel and Judah. Now, with the reading of that, we pick up kind of backing up and going forward some more in verse 6 with the conquering of the city of Jerusalem. Okay? Jerusalem at this point had really not been conquered. During the days of the conquest of the land, we know that there were some battles involving the city of Jerusalem, but it was never really conquered during that time. Jerusalem, as you know, sat up on top of a hill. It was well fortified. And who lived there? The Jebusites lived there. That's right. Now, though Joshua did kill the king, he didn't take the city. And so the city of Jerusalem is still there. Now, the Jebusites feel secure in their city. And they chide David. And I find the wording of this rather interesting. In verse 6, they said, "Except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither," thinking David cannot come in hither. What did they think that they had? They had a well-fortified place that nobody could conquer. And so the only ones they needed to guard is the blind and the lame. They could keep an army out, and David couldn't come through that. Well, David did. And if you'll notice the wording of the text in verse 8, David said on that day, "Whosoever smiteth the Jebusites, let him get up to the watercourse and smite the lame and the blind that were hated of David's soul. Wherefore they say, there are the blind and the lame, he cannot come into the house." Now that kind of becomes a proverbial saying that, well, you can't take the city unless you fight the lame and the blind. So David said, let's go fight the lame and the blind, we're going to take the city. And so that's what takes place. But I want to call your attention to the use of the expression, the water course. Some translations don't use that expression. But in verse 8, this is how David was to take the city. Now, historically, when we go back and read, how did David take the city? What does a city have to have in order to survive?
Water.
Has to have water. When we come forward, jumping forward in time to the days of the Babylonian Empire, Babylon was built on the Euphrates River. And how was Babylon destroyed? By the kings of the Medes and the Persians.
They diverted the Euphrates River.
Diverted the Euphrates River. Went around the city of Babylon. The army marched right up the dry riverbed. How does David take the city of Jerusalem? All right, you've got to get into their water supply. And that's what he did. Turn, if you will, to 2 Chronicles, or 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 11. read beginning in verses 4 through verse 8. Randy, would you read that for me, please?
Sure. You said 4 through what?
4 through 8.
David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, that is, Jebus, and the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, were there. The inhabitants of Jebus said to David, "You shall not enter here." Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. Now David had said, "Whoever strikes down a Jebusite first shall be chief and commander." Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first, so he became chief. Then David dwelt in the stronghold, therefore it was called the city of David. He built the city all around, from Millo, even to the surrounding area, and Joab prepared the rest of the city.
Some have supposed that this is how Joab reached the place and rank that he did, because he and a smaller group of men went up through what was actually a spring, I understand, that fed the city of Jerusalem. Very deep below the city, and so they made their way up the water shaft and invaded the city, or came into the city. So he was rewarded for his help in the conquering of the city. I find that interesting. But be that again as it may, the city was conquered, and some have supposed, and rightly so, that this was a good thing when David took the city because of its location. It was very centralized as far as its location in the kingdom. It was well fortified, as it was located on the mountain. It had sufficient water supply, and so it made just a very good place to become the capital of David's reign. Any question or comment just here? When we think of the Ark of the Covenant being moved here, now that brings us to some history. Where has it been?
Isn't that the house of Abinadab?
Yes, it had been in the house of Abinadab. And why was it there? All right, for safekeeping. The Philistines had taken it, you recall. And when the Philistines had taken it, what did the presence of the Ark of the Covenant do to the Philistines? Oh, it tormented them. Every place it was taken, they broke out in boils. Some translations render it, or there's another word I've forgotten now. What? Tumors. Thank you. That's used to describe how that they were smitten. So the Ark of the Covenant was recovered and brought to the city of Jerusalem. Now we know that the Ark of the Covenant was moved about by the Philistines. How? Cart pulled by cows. How did David attempt to return it?
Same way.
And of course, what happened? Didn't work out. It didn't work out. Well, in chapter 6 of our text, why didn't it work out? All right. They weren't transporting it the way that God had instructed them to transport it. We know that as it was brought to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put forth his hand to steady the ark, because the oxen had stumbled, and Uzzah died. And later we see that David explains why that occurred. In 1 Chronicles chapter 13, it was because we did not seek the transport of the Ark of the Covenant according to the commandment of God. How was it to be transported? Like that. Donna's got that. Like that. The priests carrying it on their shoulders with staves, and not on a cart pulled by cows. And so because it was not being transported properly, we know that Uzzah died, and it was later then transported in the prescribed way. Now, Hiram, king of Tyre, sends supplies for David to build a palace in the city of Jerusalem. So you see, this is becoming the capital of the people of God. Now, catch up with where I am, because I have a question I wanted to ask you. In chapter 6, the latter part of the chapter, here's my question. When you begin reading in verse 16 through the end of the chapter, you read about David bringing the ark and how that he is leaping and dancing, verse 16, before Jehovah, and Michael sees him behaving that way. And it tells us that David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Jehovah. And dropping down further in the text, it tells us that Michael came out and she said to David, verse 20, how glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself today in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants as one of the vain fellows shamelessly uncovereth himself. And David said unto Michael, it was before Jehovah who chose me above thy father and above all the house to appoint me prince over the people of Jehovah over Israel. Therefore will I play before Jehovah, and I will be yet more vile than this, and will be base in mine own sight. But of the handmaids of whom thou hast spoken, of them shall I be had in honor. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child unto the day of her death. Now, what I'm looking for is someone to explain those verses to me. Michal rebukes David. Why?
She thought he wasn't
very dignified, not acting like it. All right. That's true. He wasn't being very dignified. She thought that he was behaving himself in a very vile manner. To use the word immodestly would probably be a mild word. But doing so, as she says, before the handmaids of your servants. What is David doing? All right, he's rejoicing. He's dancing, as it were, on this occasion. Now, what we have, and I think probably the most reasonable explanation, is what we have is a difference in customs. She recognizes what he's doing as being vile. From her perspective, he says, I'm going to do things as or more vile than this. But what he's doing is rejoicing upon the returning of the Ark of the Covenant or bringing it to Jerusalem. Now, from that point forward, what became the relationship between David and Michal? Wasn't good.
Therefore, verse 23, Michal, daughter of Saul, had no child until the day of her death.
All right, do you find that interesting? Do you find that somewhat defining of the relationship between David and Michal? Okay. David has multiple wives. We're going to find that he has several concubines. But as far as Michal is concerned, they don't have a relationship, it would seem, from this point forward. All right? We'll talk more about that as we introduce our thoughts next time.